ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I'm David Marr, host of Late Night Live on Radio National, where nothing's off limits.
You know, part of being an adult is dealing with discomfort.
We gather the sharpest minds around to hash over what's shaping this crazy world.
Both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party succumbed to big money.
Late Night Live, four new shows a week on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Let me take you to 1950s New York City. The town is being terrorized by a so-called mad bomber who's setting off explosives up and down Manhattan.
He was setting the bombs off in subways, in a phone booth, in the New York Public Library, in department stores. He placed one in the Empire State Building, which has never been found. So in theory, it's still there somewhere.
Yikes. Okay, good to know. But casting back to the 1950s, this mad bomber, he hasn't killed anyone yet. But a bunch of people have been injured, and many more are terrified of going out in case they become a victim.
You know, as it approached the holiday season, the police realized that they had a very serious problem on their hands because New York, of course, is flooded with people during the holiday season. And so they were desperate to catch him before he killed anybody.
This is Michael Cannell, nonfiction author, journalist, and former editor of the New York Times.
I can tell you that I was not born, but my older brothers were born. And my own mother said that she would not take my brothers outside at the height of this bombing campaign. I mean, hysteria might be too strong a word, but people were scared to go to department stores. And the anxiety about the bombs commingled with the Cold War anxiety about the Soviet Union and nuclear bombs and so forth.
So, at the end of 1956, a lot of anxiety among the general public, and still more bombs are going off. And it's getting worse.
He set off a bomb in a movie theater in Brooklyn, and he seriously injured several people. Nobody died, but they very easily could have died. And this was a kind of precipitating event for the police. They knew that the next time they might not be so lucky. In those days, police work in New York anyway, what it really meant was roughing up suspects and roughing up informants and leaning on informants. And it was street work. And the police had never availed themselves of the help of any kind of experts. In fact, they were kind of contemptuous of the idea of going to somebody with a college degree or a doctor.
But this time, desperate and out of leads, the police would turn to a new source of help. And that turned out to be a fateful decision, because what happened next popularized a compelling but controversial police practice for decades to come.
The head of the crime lab, a man named Howard Finney, went to see Dr. James Brussel, who was a psychiatrist. His job was to run psychiatric hospitals in New York City. And because he ran the psychiatric hospitals, Dr. James Brussel had seen every emotional affliction in the world, I think. He had seen it all. And so the police showed up at his office in downtown Manhattan with a couple of duffel bags of evidence, with the bomb parts, with the letters that he had written to the newspaper.
Oh, yeah. This bomber had been writing letters to newspapers and demanding they publish them. In the letters, he'd complain about the dastardly deeds of a company that he claimed had cheated him out of compensation for injury on the job. Stuff like,
"Bombs will continue until the Consolidated Edison Company is brought to justice. I have exhausted all other means. I intend with bombs to cause others to cry out for justice for me."
The bomber would sign these letters only with the initials FP.
And Dr. Brussel spent a couple of hours going through all of the evidence. And Dr. Brussel considered himself to be a scientist, but also there was a kind of mystic aspect to his interests. And he believed that he could conduct what he called reverse psychology, which is essentially what we call criminal profiling today. And his feeling was, rather than observe the behavior of an individual and predict their future behavior, it might be possible just to observe the behavior of some unknown person and pinpoint the individual based on their behavior.
It's a pretty tantalizing prospect. Start with the characteristics of a crime and trace things back to the person who did it.
So Dr. Brussell looked at all the evidence, and then he looked out his window looking over City Hall Park in downtown Manhattan, and he thought about it, and he let his subconscious work on this. I mean, this is, I think, a kind of Jungian idea, right? It's so he let his mind, his subconscious, just conjure an image of the bomber. And he said to Captain Finney, "The man that you are looking for has never had a girlfriend. He lives with an older female relative. He's from a Slavic background. He has a history of workplace disputes. And when you catch him, he'll be wearing a double-breasted jacket."
It was such a wildly specific prediction. Could it possibly be correct? I'm Sana Qadar, and from All in the Mind, this is Forensic, our new series on the psychological means and methods used to solve crimes. Once you get away from the glossy depictions on television, how reliable is eyewitness testimony? Can anyone really reliably tell when someone is lying? And why do people confess to crimes they didn't commit? These are all questions we're tackling over the next four episodes, but today, episode one, criminal profiling. Okay, so James Brussell makes his prediction as to the identity of FP, based on the letters he sent to the newspapers and photographs from the crime scenes. As Dr. Brussell recounts in his very own memoir, Casebook of a Crime Psychiatrist:
"Middle-aged, a loner, single, living alone or with an older female relative, neat and tidy, foreign-born, and one more thing, when you catch him, he'll be wearing a double-breasted suit, buttoned."
Based on that description, the police published the profile in major newspapers, hoping to goad FP into identifying himself. FP sends several other letters, most of them mentioning his grudge against the utilities company Con Edison, which, to be fair, is already known. And meanwhile, Con Edison staff are searching their workers' compensation files, trying to find someone who might hold a grudge. Then, on Friday the 18th, January 1957, a clerk named Alice Kelly finds a file that is marked "injustice" and "permanent disability." There are letters in it complaining that the worker was treated unfairly. It's the file of a man named George Metesky, a Con Edison worker from 1929 to 1931, who was hurt in an accident at one of their plants, leaving him with permanent injuries and out of work. 4 days later, police visit the house of this George Metesky in the middle of the night with a search warrant.
When they visited his house, of course, he denied that he was FP at first. They found bomb materials in the house. He eventually came clean. One of the detectives visiting the house said to him, "What does FP stand for?"
The man replied that FP stands for fair play.
He was wearing his pajamas because it was midnight. They asked him to get dressed, and he came out of his bedroom wearing a double-breasted jacket.
Incredibly, exactly what the profile predicted.
He shared his home with two older sisters. He was from a Slavic background. He did have a history of workplace disputes. And so, I mean, it sounds almost made up, but it's all true.
The man they'd found did match pretty closely to the predictions of psychiatrist James Brussell. After they found the bomb materials in his garage, he confessed.
His name was George Metesky, and he had worked here in New York City. Con Ed is a utility company, and he had worked at Con Ed Power Plant, and he had been injured in a furnace explosion. And he had a legitimate grievance against the utility company because they really kind of cheated him out of any kind of workers' compensation. But because he was a paranoid schizophrenic, his grievance inflated in his mind into a kind of dark and grandiose paranoid scheme against all the workers in the world. And he took on this campaign with a kind of crusade mentality, almost a kind of Christ mentality, that he was going to strike back against the forces of evil and darkness.
Michael Connell is also the author of the book Incendiary, The Psychiatrist, The Mad Bomber, and the Invention of Criminal Profiling. And we're going to come back to the story of George Metesky, the so-called Mad Bomber. But first, let's jump a little further into the future to look at the practice of criminal profiling that this case helped kick off.
Criminal profiling, in the way that it's portrayed in movies and TV, is essentially the idea that offenders, particularly violent offenders and serial offenders, whether that's murder, rape, sexual assault, the idea is that those offenders leave a pattern behind in the way they offend, the way they select their victims, and more importantly, the things they do at crime scenes.
This is Professor Craig Jackson from Birmingham City University. He spent years looking into the effectiveness of criminal profiling and how the practice has influenced investigations of crime.
And one of the quotes I remember from one of the proponents is the idea that the way a crime scene is left, it's telling of the offender in the way that the soft furnishings in your home are very telling about your personality and what you like. So it had such great promise, theoretically, that the study of crime scenes could help us identify individual offenders.
While psychiatrist James Brussel was one of the first to pioneer looking at a crime's characteristics to find the culprit in the Mad Bomber case, Craig says it was the FBI who formalized the practice in the early 1970s.
So the FBI were tasked with trying to find what is behind these sex-based stranger serial murders, a new kind of crime that had been developing. When the Behavioral Analysis Unit at the FBI at Quantico was formed, and the idea was that they would speak to and almost interrogate a couple of dozen of the worst violent sexual offenders held in the American penal system or in their secure psychiatric units. And this literally meant that a small number of field agents or special agents from the Behavioral Analysis Unit went to prisons and hospitals to talk to people like Ed Kemper, Charles Manson, and a range of other high-profile serious murderers.
This happened in the late 70s.
And essentially, the FBI tried to goad them into emotional responses to make them talk about their crimes and their childhood and their background and their motivations. And the FBI used, they say, a very large, long questionnaire, and they tried to ask the same questions of each of the offenders they spoke to. The problem we have is that the FBI never released their data from this exercise to the scientific community, so it could never be scrutinized to see how valid it is or how reliable the findings were. But the FBI came up with a number of things that they thought were common to all of these heinous, violent sexual offenders, such as they would all come from backgrounds where mum was overbearing and where father was absent or weak, where the offender had a history of wetting the bed up to the age of 12 or 15 in some cases, where the offender had a history of fire starting or arson in childhood, and where the offender had been cruel to animals or taken an unnatural interest in dead bodies or, you know, dead animals and roadkill.
Those were some of the key indicators that the FBI came to believe were common in violent sexual offenders, based on these interviews.
Now, already I can tell you that's flawed because many of the offenders they spoke to don't map onto those backgrounds. They didn't all have terrible mums and weak fathers and were bedwetters. But for a good couple of decades, that view, that belief about commonality between serial murderers and violent sexual offenders, really stood firm. And the FBI stood by that. And that became the basis for when they undertook profiling exercises in crimes where they needed to find the unknown subject or the unsub. So already their building blocks for profiles were based on 20 or so interviews that were never scrutinized by the scientific community who could maybe help or nudge it in particular ways. On the basis of that, the FBI's crime scene analysis training began training field agents what to do with a crime scene and to treat it essentially in the same way that you would the physical forensic evidence, also do the same thing with the psychological evidence that may be at a crime scene. So an example being, off the top of my head, if a dead body had been tied up, the hands were tied together, the FBI agent would take that as an important psychological factor that the offender needed to restrict or restrain their victim.
Like, were the hands tied at the front or the back? What was used to tie them up?
Was it some tape that was found at the crime scene, or did the offender take some handcuffs or shackles with them? And although this seems quite trivial, the field agent would make some assessment based on something as simple as hand restraints. And they would say that if the offender took handcuffs with them, then they were clearly prepared and organized and methodical. But if the offender had panicked and had to improvise at the crime scene by using some tape that was laying around, then that would show the offender wasn't organized. They were disorganized. They weren't planning ahead. They were spontaneous.
Now, that kind of makes sense, that the crime scene would tell you something about the killer.
And it can to some extent, but it only tells us so much. Profiling means that you take every piece of evidence at the crime scene, you log it, you catalog it, and then you try to work out a narrative based on all of the behaviors that have been observed and recorded at the crime scene. The profiler then tries to come up with an idea or a range of scenarios of what could have happened and in what order and what led to the victim being found this way. And it is basically a creative process where they come up with a number of scenarios and try to see which is the best one that fits with their crime scene knowledge, their expertise, and what most rationally explains what must have happened at the crime scene. But on many occasions, that's not accurate. It makes a lovely story and it makes a great idea for an MO, but often it's far from reality. And there are many, many cases of high-profile serial murders and lesser-known cases of one-off homicides where the profile has been completely way off from what actually happened at the crime scene.
One example of that, Craig says, is the Green River Killer.
The Green River Killer was a serial killer who'd murdered between 50 and 60, possibly more, young women in the northwest of the United States, in Oregon.
This was between the 1980s and 1990s.
And most, but not all of his victims were deposited in watery areas around the sort of Green River area basin. And the actual Green River Killer, a chap called Gary Ridgway, who was responsible for these murders, and they were sex-based murders, he actually wrote to a local newspaper and had described some of the killings and the victims in great detail in a way that only the killer would possibly know. These were details that hadn't been released, etc. So the local law enforcement got hold of this letter and they sent it to the FBI for their help in not only forensically examining the letter, you know, for palm prints or any kind of forensic element, but they asked the behavioral analysis unit two questions. Is this letter likely to be from the killer? And how can we use this to help catch the killer?
The FBI wrote back to local law enforcement and said, in short, this is not your killer. This is somebody who's trying to inject themselves into the proceedings.
They essentially said the real killer would not tell you all of these details and the real killer would not correspond in such detail. And it turns out, unfortunately, that years later, when Gary Ridgway was arrested, it was a genuine letter by him.
From ABC Radio National, you're listening to All in the Mind with me, Sana Qajar. Now, that organized disorganized pattern that Craig mentioned, the belief that offenders fall into one or the other, it came out of that original FBI work. But holes have been poked in it over time.
David Chantrew is probably the most well-known criminal psychologist in the UK, I would argue. He reviewed a number of homicides, serial homicides, and less high-profile homicides, and he tried to apply the organized and disorganized application to each offender. And in the end, he found that it didn't hold water, that the idea of organized offenders behaving in this way and disorganized offenders behaving in that way didn't map out onto the reality of how crimes were committed. And when you think about it, the FBI were being incredibly ambitious. We are many things, and we're not all either organized or disorganized in our lives. So you may be very organized in your finances, and your dishwasher may be stacked very tidily and organized well, but your den could be an absolute mess, and your car could be full of papers and crumbs and crisp packets. So we are both organized and disorganized in our lives. Why would offenders be any other way?
Okay, so to recap where we're at, the people we spoke to for this episode, as well as the broad literature in this area, isn't that positive about this kind of criminal profiling. As you can hear, it's been criticized as broad brush and unscientific, leading investigators away from the offender as often, or maybe more often, than it points towards them. But there are other approaches built on some of the ideas within criminal profiling that are still in use today, like investigative psychology.
Investigative psychology basically allows psychologists to research and hopefully inform investigations, both live ones and cold case investigations, to give likelihoods or probabilities about certain offenders' involvement in those cases, or also helping to guide what kind of individual the unsub may be in a live investigation. The big difference is it doesn't have this intuitive element that the FBI's profiling originally did. So it's data that we've amassed from, you know, unfortunately, thousands and thousands of violent crimes and sexual crimes that allow us to now confidently say most offenders who do this tend to come from this background or have this kind of current ongoing situation. So it's much more data-driven.
Another really data-driven approach, sometimes said to be part of investigative psychology, is called geographic profiling.
Geographic profiling, it essentially leverages geography, crime, and behavior to try to figure out where an offender lives or where one of their anchor points are.
This is Dr. Victoria Berezowski, a lecturer in forensic science at Deakin University.
And an anchor point is something, a location where someone frequents often, like every day. So work could be an anchor point, or if someone goes to the gym every day religiously, then the gym could also be an anchor point. But essentially what geographic profiling does is it amalgamates geographical information, criminological theory information, and psychology, as well as some maths to try to figure out where that offender could possibly live. It's essentially an investigative tool to narrow down the search for someone.
Like criminal profiling, its history goes back decades, to the 1970s.
So geographic profiling is rooted in three criminological theories: crime pattern, rational choice, and routine activity. Crime pattern theory posits that what an offender does is not random, but their crimes happen in a space that they know usually really well and a space that they feel comfortable in. Rational choice, kind of it's a bit of an opposite to crime pattern theory, is that, well, offenders offend in a space that's familiar to them. It can't be a place that's too comfortable because then the chance of detection is increased. So you have to weigh up the pros and cons. And then the third one is routine activity.
Victoria says this refers to when there are three elements in play: a suitable target, a motivated offender, and the absence of a guardian. Now, a guardian doesn't necessarily mean a physical person standing there. It can mean CCTV.
But essentially, when those three elements converge, crime can happen.
So while you start with a few assumptions about human behavior, these aren't leaps of reason, like in some elements of criminal profiling. They're patterns that humans fairly consistently follow at a population level. Armed with these pieces of information about how people behave and how crimes occur, it can be really useful to map out certain locations during a criminal investigation. Obvious stuff like the crime scenes themselves, but also where victims and suspects worked, the restaurants they liked, their gym, their friends' houses. All of this builds up the geographical picture of their lives.
Essentially, what mapping all of these locations does is it creates two spaces. One is called the activity space, and a great way to describe your activity space is anywhere that you can go without a map. So your house, the grocery store, the gym, even your friends' houses. If you can go there without a map, that's in your activity space. The second space is what we call an awareness space. And it's just outside of the activity space. It's just areas that they might not know as well. Using a geographic dispersal of crimes to try to figure out either where they're going to hit next or where they can be found is very common.
Victoria says that in Australia, the AFP, the Australian Federal Police, have a geographic profiling capability.
So they'll use it on all kinds of serial crimes. Could be serial homicide, which is obviously really rare in Australia, but could be also any like financial crimes that are serial in nature.
But if we go back to criminal profiling, like Craig, Victoria isn't convinced that that approach is useful.
People commit crimes for very rational reasons, and you can group offenders in their motivations. But I think human behavior, from a pure motivational standpoint, that's probably the chaotic part. Whereas when we're actually thinking, like we have to make a decision of where to bury this body, it's not chaos. It's rational thoughts that almost every person, every other person is going to make that same decision. But not every person is going to make the decision to kill someone in the first place. So whereas offender or criminal profiling will try to find a person based on their motivations and, you know, why they act and how they act, with geographic profiling, it's based in geography. You have more data points. It's more set in theory, more rooted in theory than I think criminal profiling is. Like, I get students all the time saying they want to be a profiler. And I have to tell them that it's actually not a real job. Forensic psychologists are used a lot to decide if someone is fit to stand trial. Like, they'll assess a known offender, but very rarely are their skills actually used to work backwards to find an offender. Like, that's a TV thing and maybe a US thing. It's not a thing here.
In recent decades, criminal profiling has fallen out of favor among many police units worldwide. Critics who research it argue that it doesn't stack up, profiles don't perform better than those who don't use the approach, and the science is shaky. But techniques grounded in data and statistics have grown in popularity at the same time. Now, remember FP, who we heard about at the start of the show, the mad bomber George Metesky? What happened to him? And what happened to the psychiatrist James Brussel? Well, for George,
he never really does go to trial. It is determined that he is criminally insane. He had pulmonary injuries from the furnace blast, and he almost died on the eve of a trial. And then he was sent to a psychiatric hospital. And one of the many ironies of the story is that he really outlived everybody else in the story and was eventually released. He lived a long life as a free man.
George died at the age of 90 in 1994. As for psychiatrist James Brussel, author Michael Cannell says he became a kind of quirky, eccentric celebrity. He was involved in finding the man who had been dubbed the Boston Strangler.
A man who was strangling single women in Boston. And Dr. Brussel played an important role in figuring out, in criminal profiling, in figuring out who the culprit was and so on and so forth with several other cases.
He spoke to the FBI and told them about his approach, which informed their development of criminal profiling. Though, as we've heard, it's changed a lot since.
The FBI depends on so much data. It's a data-driven discipline now. Although I have noticed that if you speak to profilers now, FBI profilers, they will acknowledge that there is still this element of intuition, which is what Dr. Brussell originally was about. He was about the intuition. There are people who will say, you know, that profiling is a kind of phony science. I guess what I would say is that in the cases that Dr. Brussell worked on, it's hard. I think they would have eventually caught these offenders, but it certainly shortened the amount of time.
That is it for episode 1 of Forensic, our new 4-part series on the psychological means and methods used to solve crimes. Next week, we're diving into false confessions and how they can be planted or coerced if police aren't careful. In this episode, you heard from Michael Cannell, author and former editor of the New York Times, Professor Craig Jackson from Birmingham City University, and Dr. Victoria Berezowski, lecturer in forensic science at Deakin University. Thanks to producer Rose Kerr, senior producer James Bullen, and sound engineer Isabella Trapiano. I'm Sana Kadar. Thanks for listening. I'll catch you next week for episode 2 of Forensic.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.